Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You got supply-demand, you got cost-benefit, and today in coronavirus macroeconomic news, you got cause and effect. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 29th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today, as I said, with a little bit of cause and effect, in which we pair this morning's report on first quarter economic growth. Spoiler alert, there wasn't any. With this afternoon's press conference by Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell. From the good people at the Commerce Department came data this morning showing gross domestic product, the sum and total of the goods and services this economy produces, falling 4.8% in the first quarter. You dig into the fine print, as we are wont to do, and you see household spending was down about 7.5%. Purchases of services fell more than 10%. Business equipment spending fell more than 15%. I could go on, but I got to let Mitchell Hartman have a turn here.
The economy was cranking along in January and February. Then in early March, we started to hear warnings about the need for COVID-19 social distancing and statewide lockdowns. Initially, that sent consumers out shopping to stock up, including at Tom Butcher's music shop in Seattle.
You know, they really wanted to get some music instruments, some toys maybe to occupy themselves.
But by the middle of March, his store was shut down and
most of our business just disappeared.
Multiply that by tens of millions of businesses across the country, and says Capital Economics' Paul Ashworth, the economy
just fell off a cliff, and we went from everything being open to everything closed.
It's not just stores and restaurants and the like. Spending on healthcare is down too, says University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson.
To make room for COVID patients, hospitals really had to shut down a lot of non-essential treatment.
Now, keep in mind, these declines happened in the last 3 weeks of the quarter. The economic shutdown really took hold in April. And Paul Ashworth predicts
the decline in the second quarter was much bigger than the first quarter. We're thinking it's somewhere around 40%.
On the plus side, Ashworth notes, some states are reopening, people are getting stimulus checks and unemployment and small business loans. But that prediction of a 40% decline in GDP this quarter already includes all that stimulus money flowing in. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now, you could quibble, should you so choose, with our cause and effect timing device here, because honestly, the Fed was jumping in well before we had actual data like GDP growth. But the real Fed marker of this crisis? Here's Tim Dewey of the University of Oregon.
So I guess the number one would be the speed with which these programs were brought out. Really, the Fed rushed to try to save the financial system in a way that we really haven't seen in the past.
Not even, it should be said, in 2007 and 2008. Number two, staying with Tim Dewey here on the list of ways this Fed isn't like other Feds, is to whom it is lending.
The Fed is designed and operates really through large sector, you know, financial institutions. It's not an institution that's designed to reach out more generally to Main Street.
Because?
Basically, you work with the banking sector. The banking sector reaches out to Main Street.
But?
Right now, the focus on Main Street is dealing with the closures, the layoffs associated with that. And it's hard to see that there'd be probably an even bigger round of layoffs and closures absent the stabilization of the financial sector.
Which gets us to this from Sarah Binder at George Washington University.
That inherently gets them into political waters.
And oh, look what Chair Powell said today.
I would say that policies that protect workers, businesses, and households from avoidable insolvency, that keep businesses going so that they're able to produce goods and to either hold on to their employees or quickly rehire them. Those are going to be key policies. They'll come with a hefty price tag, but we would come out of this event eventually with a stronger economy and with less long-run damage to the economy. So that's a key thing that that really Congress could do over time.
I'm going to say something now, and once you hear it, you are going to say, Kai, no, come on, man. And I'm going to say, yeah, I don't know either. But here goes. Wall Street today, traders blew the doors off to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just because you can never have too much Jay Powell in the program, here is one more from the Fed chair today talking about the national debt and how much more of it we have now than we did 6 weeks ago with those big rescue packages.
This is not the time to act on those concerns. This is the time to use the great fiscal power of the United States to do what we can to support the economy and try to get through this with as little damage to the longer run productive capacity of the economy as possible.
To be clear, Powell did say we are going to have to act on those concerns eventually, so we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler what that might entail.
Given the gravity of COVID-19, most economists agree with the government spending big.
We are spending it at the right time. We need to make ends meet for a lot of people.
But George Barrow at Rice University says we can't ignore the long-term consequences of the debt we're racking up.
I don't think we can just wish it away.
He says politicians never want to tell voters about the need to balance the budget through tax hikes or spending cuts. Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, says that's been the problem for a long time.
The United States built $9 trillion additional dollars of debt during what was the longest economic boom in American history.
And instead of paying down debt, we passed tax cuts and more spending bills. David Primo at the University of Rochester says there's a problem with the argument some offer that we don't have to worry about debt as long as there's economic growth.
If the government has to print money to pay our debt, and it's just not feasible to raise taxes to do so, interest rates are going to go up. That means that inflation is going to be a problem.
And higher interest rates would mean debt eating up a big part of the federal budget. Maya McInnes is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The cost of very small increases in interest rates is very high because our debt load is so high.
That puts pressure on the Fed to keep rates low, particularly with an economy that's been hit so hard. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We did a segment back during the European debt crisis called What's Up, Europe? Had a catchy little audio signature that we played in the introduction.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
I still love that. Well, we are going to plagiarize ourselves just a little bit, because why not, for a new segment about how people in this global economy are dealing with the coronavirus.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, world?
What's up, world? Samantha Wallace owns From Field and Flower. It's a honey shop in London's Borough Market. We met a year something ago, I guess, as she was getting ready for Brexit. Samantha, welcome back to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. We have spoken, you and I, over the past year plus, mostly about Brexit and your honey shop that you have in the Borough Market there in London. These are different times and different contingencies. How have you been doing?
We're okay. We've got a history of talking about Brexit and all the changes that that may or may not bring. And instead, it's rather been gate crashed by the lockdown and by the pandemic. So, you know, lots of other people are having a much worse experience than us. So I can't complain too much, but it is a very strange time.
Is the shop still open?
No, it's not. So Borough Market as a whole is open, because there are lots of traders who are grocers who do fruit and veg or meat or fish or what we would call essential produce. And because I have elderly parents that I need to look after, I couldn't work myself. And it just felt wrong to ask our staff to work when there's no need for them to work. It's not life or death for them. And we are not doing anything as vitally important that it's life or death for other people. So it just felt like the right thing is to close now for the lockdown and see what happens afterwards.
Can you do online sales? I mean, are you generating any revenue?
Yeah, we are. We have a tiny little online shop because I have to confess we're not the great sort of people at technology. And we are far more based in being face-to-face retail. You know, we like to chat. We like to talk about what we love. And online is kind of a developing thing. So we're going up in sales, which is wonderful for online. But generally speaking, there is a big hole in our turnover, sadly. So we're losing quite a lot of money. But effectively, the bit of money we're getting helps morale, helps us kind of feel positive, but also helps us continue to pay our staff while they're on lockdown.
Have you been able to take advantage, or have you decided to take advantage of any of the relief programs that the British government is offering? I mean, what are you doing there?
Well, so for us, we've applied for a grant from our, what we have is a local council where Borough Market is based, and they have a grant for micro businesses like us. Otherwise, there are various government lending schemes, but because they're lending at the moment, we're not sure if we want to do that because we're just not sure what the future holds. You know, the experts are saying that it looks like social distancing is going to be in place till at least next year, certainly until a vaccine is found. And so we're kind of thinking, to be honest, how can a little business like ours that is thriving in a bustling, busy Borough Market, which is wonderful if you can rub shoulder to shoulder with your fellow visitor, but not great if you have to try and be 2 meters away at all times.
That's disheartening. Do you think this might cost you this business that you and your husband have built?
Oh, I don't know. I hope not. I'm quite the optimist. So I do like things that things will, you know, kind of go back to normal or that something magical will happen and, you know, it will be okay. But, and sadly, a little business like ours, which is effectively quite niche, you know, you have to be quite into your honey to be really a regular customer of ours, which is wonderful. But that doesn't really survive on a modern high street, sadly. There might be something to it online that we could develop, but it's tricky and it's just not knowing the future. And sadly, I suspect we're a few months away from having any inkling of what that's going to look like.
Well, Samantha, really lovely to speak with you again. Samantha Wallace, she and her husband own a shop in London's Borough Market. It's called From Field and Flower. It's a honey shop. Samantha, thanks again. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Kai. Take care.
Coming up.
My full disclosure will be that I've always felt like your kids were smarter than you are.
That actually is a true fact. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 532 points today, 2.2%, 24,633. The NASDAQ up 306, 3.5%. Finished at 89.14. The S&P 500 added 76 points, 2.6%. Finished at 29.39. Here's what's going on with the rally. Cancer drug manufacturer Chimerix has started a trial of one of its drugs to treat COVID-19 patients with serious lung injuries. Shares up more than 40% there. Meanwhile, Gilead Sciences, they do pharmaceuticals, announced that one of its drugs can effectively treat coronavirus patients. Shares up 5.6% there. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 0.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a while since OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has been frontline news. But President Trump's decision to declare meat processing plants as critical infrastructure has done it. Some of those plants, as you've heard, surely have become coronavirus hotspots. Thousands of workers have gotten sick. As many as 20 have died. That's from the union that represents those workers. It's OSHA's job to protect workers in this economy. All of us in normal times, essential workers in particular right now. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on what the agency can and cannot do.
OSHA creates safety rules that employers have to follow. That's its most important function, says David Michaels, the former head of OSHA under the Obama administration. For example, at the height of the AIDS crisis, the agency issued rules for the disposal of needles in healthcare facilities.
And as a result of that standard, every hospital room, for example, every doctor's office has a sharps container.
Sharps container, basically a sealed box for needles. But it usually takes years of study and debate to come up with those rules when there's no time to waste, like in a public health emergency.
The agency should issue an emergency standard.
OSHA hasn't done that yet. It has put out workplace guidelines that basically say to follow the CDC. Debbie Berkowitz is with the National Employment Law Project.
CDC guidance is advisory. It's voluntary. Employers do not have to follow it. They can choose to ignore it.
Employers are legally obligated to provide a workplace free from recognized hazards, says John Henshaw, who headed OSHA during the George W. Bush administration. But when it comes to COVID,
this is all new for everybody. So it's kind of hard to argue it was a known hazard and you should have done something about it.
When employers are suspected of violating OSHA standards, they're subject to inspections and then fines, says Anne Rosenthal, a former top lawyer for the agency. But the number of inspectors that enforce rules is limited.
And it would take 165 years for them to get to every workplace in the country.
Inspections can be triggered by employee complaints. OSHA has received thousands of those since the pandemic began, but has issued no citations to employers so far. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the meatpacking plants that's been closed down because of this virus is the Smithfield Foods pork plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We were out there 6, maybe 7 years ago, talking to some of the workers in that plant. You can hear that story at marketplace.org. So here's a thought. You run a small business, the economy implodes, your business is at risk. The government offers an emergency loan lifeline and you decide not to take it. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on the PPP desk.
Back in mid-March, before the PPP program started, Heather Whaling ran the numbers for the PR company she runs, called Gebbin Communication. She had already made cuts to her business and realized her outlook was pretty good. When the program launched on April 3rd, she didn't apply.
It just felt like there were other people who needed the money more than we did.
Plus, forgiveness of a PPP loan is based on requirements that businesses maintain or quickly rehire employees and maintain salary levels. Whaling says she didn't want to be held to those kinds of requirements.
That could potentially make me make decisions that maybe weren't in the best interest of the company long term, but I was making them because of some requirement of a loan that I had to fulfill.
Part of the issue is that for many people who have lost their jobs, unemployment insurance, which includes $600 a week in emergency pandemic benefits, pays more than what they'd be making if their old jobs hired them back. Matt Hetrick runs an accounting company called Harmony Group in Maryland. It works with small businesses, including a lot of restaurants.
You can't really say to a line cook, I want you to come back and work 50 or 60 hours a week to make less money and put yourself at risk.
Some restaurants have been looking at that math and realizing the PPP program isn't really worth it.
The details just really didn't seem to fit.
Genevieve Villamora is the co-owner of a restaurant in Washington, D.C. called Bad Saint, which shut down operations on March 15th. Villamora didn't apply for a PPP loan. Even if she reopened, she doesn't think she'd have the business necessary to hire back all of her workers or the space for people to safely work.
Restaurants are packed, usually in the dining room and in the back of the house. In many of the parts where you can't see where staff are working, it's a lot of people. It takes a lot of people to run a restaurant.
The loans charge 1% if they aren't forgiven. But Villamora says for businesses like hers, that could still mean having to shell out big monthly payments.
We're a really small restaurant. We have 17 employees. Any amount of debt that we are taking on is a big deal to us.
Villamora says in the meantime, she's been applying for private grants. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Leslie Knope is back. She and everybody else from Pawnee are getting together for a special episode of Parks and Rec. NBC tomorrow night. It's a benefit for Feeding America. Michael Shore is one of the creators of that show, also of The Office and The Good Place. Mike, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
The nuts and bolts of the special in just a second, but I have been wondering ever since I found out about this thing, actually, how hard is it to be creative when we're in the situation we are in?
Well, you know, it's nearly impossible. It's impossible to do a lot of things, frankly. For people who are used to working on TV shows, which are enormous collaborative efforts involving hundreds of people in dozens of different departments, you know, it's not even an option, really. And there's a lot of anxiety, I think, not only in terms of, you know, projects that were interrupted and people had to be laid off and stuff like that, but also, you know, looking to the future when we're on the other side of this. You know, until there's an actual vaccine that prevents this disease from spreading, it's hard to imagine how we make anything, really. And I think that's what we're all wrestling with right now is, like, how is this ever going to go back to what it was?
Well, you are a television producer of some renown, and I imagine you've got projects hither and yon. You're stopped down, I guess, on those projects?
Yeah, I mean, we were in the middle of a production meeting on a new show I'm working on called Rutherford Falls. It's going to be on the new Peacock streaming network. At some point, I don't know, in the future. And, you know, we were just about to shoot the pilot, and in the middle of the production meeting, we got word that everything was stopping. And there's other projects. You know, there's an animated show that's continued working called Q-Force for Netflix that, you know, the writers had to just go remote. And, you know, we made this Parks and Recreation special completely remotely. Like, there's a bunch of stuff at a bunch of different stages. But everything sort of came to a halt, at least temporarily, and then we've been slowly trying to figure out how to get any aspect of it back up and running.
So NBC calls and says, hey, Mike, the world as we know it has come to a screeching halt. How about a reboot? And you said what?
Well, what they actually said was, you know, look, we have nothing to air, you know. They have nothing to put on TV. And they first asked if the cast of Parks and Rec would reunite and just do like a table read of an old episode or something. And I said I was happy to ask, but that I thought if we did it, it should be some kind of fundraiser. So they were very happy with that plan. I emailed the cast. They all got back to me almost instantly. And once that was the case, I sort of had a second wave of feeling, which was, well, if we're getting this whole cast back together, it kind of seemed like a waste to just do in something that we've already done. And so I had two thoughts very quickly. One is, I think we have to write something new. And the second was, oh, God, that's going to be so much work to make that happen. So, but, you know, I rallied some of the old writers, and we got a whole bunch of people on the crew back together, and everybody was really happy to essentially volunteer their time. And I'm really happy that we were able to do it, and I'm even happier that we're doing it for a good cause, which is Feeding America, which is a nationwide food bank that's going to help a lot of people.
So a couple of full disclosures here, and then the last question. The first is that you have been gracious enough to come by Marketplace, and you've done a brown bag lunch once or twice and shared your thoughts on creativity, which was great and amazing for us as a newsroom. The other full disclosure, which I'm not sure I've ever told you, is that I personally am not the biggest Parks and Rec fan. So
really?
That's on the table. Yeah, you know, what can I tell you? But I say that as prologue to this. My kids are, and my 16 now, he's 16 years old. My 16-year-old and my 18-year-old, who's home from college, are spending hours on the couch watching Parks and Rec reruns. And I wonder, I mean, you're a guy who's intentional about his work, who knows it has meaning, and we talked about this when we had you on for The Good Place. Does it give you pause that people are turning to you for distraction in a moment of pandemic?
Well, my full disclosure will be that I've always felt like your kids were smarter than you are. so that's from my end. And it is very nice, I have to say, to hear stories of shows I've worked on being distractions or deliverers of momentary joy to people. That is a very nice thing. There is a certain sort of sense of responsibility that I think people feel when it comes to creating stuff for TV, especially because, you know, no one could have predicted this, obviously, or actually no one who isn't a scientist could have predicted this.
That's right.
But when people are using your work as a way to, you know, try to keep their spirits up, that's a very meaningful thing. And I consider myself lucky to have worked on shows where that's the case.
Parks and Rec, special tomorrow night on NBC. Mike Shore is the guy in charge. Mike, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which one gives silent thanks that all the children who are home are all teenagers sitting on the couch, as I said, watching Parks and Rec reruns, happy to be socially distant from their parents. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. Hasbro reported profits this morning. Sales up 25% in the first quarter. Monopoly's big. Jenga, Connect Four, also Play-Doh. Anything, I suppose, to pass the time. I'm kidding. By the way, my kids are great. They mostly tolerate me. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's up 532 points today, 2.2%. The NASDAQ up 306 points. That's 3.5%. NASDAQ added 76, 2.6% there. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. Once again, the people going into the studios so the rest of us don't have to. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.